Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to have a continuation of our series, Conversations with Remarkable Minds. We're going to talk about how do we get humans back into balance with nature and our societies and our cultures. My guest will be Dr. Elizabeth Sartoris. Dr. Sartoris is an evolution biologist, a philosopher, a futurist, and a former professor specializing in the designs of living systems. In addition to having taught at MIT and the University of Massachusetts, she has also been a consultant through the UN to Indigenous peoples, and she is the author of a very important work called Biology Revisited, as well as Earth Dancing, Living Systems. So she will be in an extended comment section a little later in the program. Also today, I'm going to do most of the issues just in a little abbreviated form because I promised I would discuss the original in-depth investigative report, Why Does the American Academy of Pediatrics Put Corporate Profits Ahead of Children's Health? This is a posted paper today. It is being posted all over the internet. Please share it with everyone that you can. It's from myself and Richard Gale, one of our scholars in residence. Also today, if time permits, from George Monbiot from monbiot.com, Time to Face the Facts, Our Level of Consumption is Pathological. Why do we need to buy all the things we do, especially at this time of year? And from Evelyn Pringle and Martha Rosenberg from Alternet, How Kids Are Getting Hooked on Pills for Life. Interesting short piece from the environmental segment of our program today, A Wake-Up Call on the Hudson, It's Really Dirty. Riverkeepers give us their latest report on that, including the beaches we're swimming in, and the ecosystems in upheaval, biodiversity in collapse. Now, who's saying this? Some apocalyptic writers? No. This is the U.S. Geological Survey and the National Wildlife Federation and Arizona State University on the loss globally of biodiversity and major shifts in our ecosystems. What does all this mean? As you see, we have a lot to share. Our issues today, signs that the U.S. poverty is exploding. But who's it hurting most? Children and young adults. From Economic Collapse blog, I'll share that with you as well. As you see, we have a lot to talk about. Let's begin. We should all be eating a diet that provides good bacteria. Now, good bacteria mainly come from fermented foods. For example, sauerkraut or sauerkraut juice is an excellent way of getting those nice billions of good bacteria into our body. But the Chinese and Japanese and the South Koreans have been doing this for a long time with fermented rice, fermented soy. They're called misos, M-I-S-O. They're paste. You can take a teaspoon of that paste, put it in some hot water, and immediately you liberate billions of good bacteria that help with the immune system and recolonize the gut, especially if you've had a cold or flu, especially if you're having a stress on your immune system. It's just good for you. And there are other things like also, for example, kefir and some dairy products, organic hopefully, that also provide good bacteria. Here's the latest study on this to show you why, for women, it could be important. It could help prevent cystitis. And we know that cystitis is a very painful urinary tract infection. And it is a painful bacterial condition that begins in the urinary tract system. Well, women, we know, are far more likely to develop a urinary tract infection than men. In fact, it's about 80% of women will experience a urinary tract infection in their lifetime. And it leads to a lot of problems. So one of the things this study showed is that there is a lack of good bacteria. The vaginal lactobacilli, and often reoccur, and most can be treated repeatedly, but when women are taking antibiotics, you're destroying the good bacteria. You're killing some of the bad bacteria, but then the bad bacteria proliferate faster than the good bacteria, especially in women who are carrying any infection. So what they did is this. They took a group of women who had recurring urinary tract infections. They gave half the women a probiotic and the other half a placebo for 5 days. And they did this on and off for 10 weeks. The results showed that those that received the probiotics, the good bacteria, substantially reduced their infection rate. So the outcome of this study shows that we should be having probiotics in women every day to help prevent urinary tract infections. I'm always looking for ways to take very complex issues and make them easy to understand. There's no need for a problem to be as complex in its solutions as it is in its complications. For example, diabetes. It may take years of overeating, carbohydrates, lack of exercise, before we end up with prediabetes or diabetes conditions. And then you have a whole lot of problems. More likely to have a heart attack, a stroke, cancer, and depression. So what can we do to make it really simple? Well, with over 26 million Americans officially diagnosed, and over 100 million Americans, one-third of the entire population now, considered pre-diabetic and are much higher risk of developing diabetes, it's clear that we're not doing a lot of things right. So I'm going to give you 4 herbs that can make a difference, a big difference. Now, of course, we should start to exercise. That brings down blood sugar. We should get away from high sugar foods or foods that spike our blood sugar levels, what is called the glycemic level. And those would be refined flour products, muffins and bagels and pastas, and refined carbohydrates and sweetened beverages. Those, get those out of your diet and start eating more beans. Beans are really good protein. They're really good complex carbohydrate, and they have a low glycemic index, and they're alkalizing. All good if you are pre-diabetic. But what can we do for herbs? Well, the number one herb I would recommend for anyone suffering from pre-diabetes, which is most of the people overweight, and diabetes would be cinnamon. That's right, cinnamon. It is a very important herb for diabetes. It acts as an insulin sensitizer. In one study, 60 adults with type 2 diabetes were regularly given cinnamon, and they dropped 29% in their average blood sugar levels. That is good, but there are a lot of other studies out there also showing the power of cinnamon in your daily regimen. So my suggestion, make yourself a green apple drink with celery and cucumber and sprinkle some cinnamon in it. That's a good way to help with blood sugar purification, cleansing the liver. It's all around good. Next would be fenugreek. Fenugreek, fen, F-E-N-U-G-R-E-E-K, fenugreek, is a Middle Eastern herb. It's used in a lot of the dishes over there. And what it does, it reduces blood sugar. It increases insulin sensitivity and reduces high cholesterol. 25 grams of the seed each day could significantly improve blood sugar and post-meal spikes in blood sugar. Now remember, it takes about 28 grams to make an ounce. So we're talking about just a little under an ounce. You can get it as a powder where they just simply crush the fenugreek seed, and or you could take just almost a teaspoon of fenugreek seeds and throw them into a blender. That would be another way of doing it. You could also eat fenugreek sprouts. You could make a fenugreek sprout salad. That would also be great as well. Then something has been used by billions of cumulative people in the Orient, ginseng. Ginseng is very important, especially in tincture form, It's immune boosting and disease fighting. It is an adaptogen and allows carbohydrates better absorption. It improves your body's blood glucose level and increases insulin production in the pancreas. In fact, there was a study at the University of Toronto that found ginseng can lower blood sugar by up to 20%. And finally, there is an herb that is native to India that they use for metabolic disorders, including diabetes. It lowers your blood sugar by blocking sugar-binding sites in the cells and not allowing the glucose to accumulate in the body. It increases insulin production, and it is called Gymnema, Gymnema, N-E-M-A, Sylvestre, S-Y-L-V-E-S-T-R-E. So those are all important for you. Simple, inexpensive, easy to take. From Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health, an interesting study also published in the British Medical Journal Open. It says, physicians admit feeling underqualified and lacking necessary education to treat obesity. Now, mind you, when you consider that almost 50% of all Americans are overweight, and that only 44% of primary care physicians reported success in helping obese patients fight to lose weight, then who are you going to go to? Well, it's simple. Qualified nutritionists and or holistic, and I underline holistic dietitians. Now, being a registered dietitian and a registered nutritionist and a PhD in human nutrition and public health science, this is something I feel qualified to talk about, because medical school pays attention mainly to classically defined illnesses and has principally a pharmacological approach to treating them. Well, it's not a deficiency of a pharmaceutical drug that causes obesity. It is a myriad of reasons, and you have to be able to sit patiently and go through each one before you open the door that actually reveals what is causing a person to overeat, what is causing a person to eat the wrong foods in the wrong combinations in the wrong quantities at the wrong pace. All that has to be understood. Now, for example, you've heard me mention repeatedly recently about the food program shows that are the most popular on television are offering the worst foods in the worst amounts, in fact, eating upwards of 5 to 6 pounds of a given food at a given meal. Yesterday, I gave you an example of how one popular program, the man consumed over 900 grams of protein, animal protein, at a single serving, and over 4,000 calories in a single meal. That would exhaust the person's pancreas, overtax the person's liver and kidneys and blood, and put him at great risk of having a heart attack or stroke. But that doesn't stop people from watching it and saying, that looks interesting, let me try it. So your physician is not going to be able to help with that. You need someone who is experienced in understanding human nature, why we do the things we do, peer pressure, media manipulation, making it seem cool and in and hip, and then we may not do it to extremes, but we're still doing it. We like salty and crunchy and soft and sweet. All bad for us in the current way that we eat. So I'm suggesting that you work with someone who themselves is healthy. I see no reason to sit down with someone and ask their advice on a topic that they are not an example of it. I remember once being at the National Health Federation, my very first meeting. I had a monster best-selling book, the most popular selling health book in history, The Complete Handbook of Nutrition. The year was 1972. And I had been invited because this was a crossover book, meaning it was big in the health movement, but it was very big in the mainstream movement. And at this health conference, when I went in the door where all the speakers were meeting, the room was filled with cigarette smoke. and they had a bar set up where all the speakers, Carlton Fredrickson, Adele Davis, and all the others were, you know, throwing down the shots of whiskey. And they had food, but it all was terrible food, little pork sausages on a little piece of white bread. And I'm looking at all this, and the man who was sponsoring came over. He's still alive today, a nice man from the National Health Federation. He said, "Hi, Gary." He said, "Welcome to what I hope will not be your last event with us." And so I watched these people consuming this. Then I watched this very morbidly obese man waddle out on stage to talk about overcoming arthritis, but he had arthritis, and how to be slim, but he was 450 pounds, how to grow hair, and he was bald, and something about how to improve your sex life, and I could only imagine. And I'm looking as people were taking notes, and then afterwards he walked out, and half the audience left with him to go buy his books. I'm thinking, wow, what did I miss that they got? But that's how it went. The people talking about health were not healthy, emotions were not qualified just by their own life experience. So my rule is simple. Talk with people who are living the lesson they're teaching. And it shouldn't be about money. Oh, we've had that recently, haven't we? Well, if you want to become successful, come to a seminar and spend $5,000. And then you find out, how did you just come to more seminars? Oh, and if you want to learn the right kind of yoga, come and we'll give you one good class, inexpensive, and then we'll get you into it. And then we have to take you to another level, which we're going to charge you $8,000, another level $10,000. And suddenly a person is something more than a member of a cult run by people for money and fame. We've got to get out of this spiritual materialistic supermarket we've been in. Look for the simple lessons in life that come from simple people who are examples of it. And that's not your physician. Motivation to study is what gives you a good grade in math, not your IQ. We have this myth that somehow IQ matters. It doesn't. The IQ tests are stupid and lacking any sense of capacity to understand a person's innate intelligence. But we hold on to these. This is from the Society for Research in Child Development and published in the journal Child Development. Quote, "It's not how smart students are, but how motivated they are and how they study that determines their growth in math achievement." Quote, and then it goes on to talk about why we're looking at students who are highly motivated, who have moderate or even low IQs, who do very well in math because they're motivated. Well, how about if they were motivated and willing to study and learn in all their classes, all the different fields? That means they'd have a very high IQ. That doesn't mean that they have some genetic predisposition to being smarter. They're just more motivated. Infants as medical guinea pigs, from Elizabeth Renter from Natural Society. This is short but worth listening to. Quote, "When Big Pharma wants a drug approved, ideally they should go through several stages of trials and tests, where the drug is tested for effectiveness and side effects before being approved. But what happens when the intended audience for the drug are children or infants or babies? Many children have been victimized by doctors prescribing adult drugs without knowing their effects on smaller and younger people. And it's because of this that some are calling the drug companies to run more trials, this time on infants." Quote, "Newborns, according to experts, are, quote, underrepresented populations, end quote, in the world of clinical drug trials. While pediatric drug studies are becoming more common, testing newborns remains rare for a variety of reasons." And so it goes on to talk about how they're now testing infants. In one case, kids young as, as young as 7, were tested with OxyContin, a heavy-duty narcotic painkiller, primarily to keep its patent. The maker of OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, decided to test the drug on children as young as 6 years old. By starting new trials on children, Purdue was able to extend their patent for 6 months. So here is my question. How do we know, without independent tests being done and using placebo as the qualifying measure, how do we know that any of the drugs that we are using are safe and effective? Virtually all the major cases of chickenpox and mumps and measles in the last year were in groups that were fully vaccinated. Well, clearly then, it wasn't effective and safe for them. And what about the 60 to 500,000 who died using Vioxx, a painkiller, a COX-2 inhibitor? It wasn't safe for them, and nobody had to apologize, and nobody admitted guilt. They paid a fine, and it was the cost of doing business, and they got away with killing 60,000 Americans. All these drugs every day, none of them are tested the way they should, and never by independent scientists. They're always tested by the pharmaceutical company, and they can hide the bad results. So now they want to test children. And where do they normally test young children? In third world countries, in Africa, and in the Philippines, and in Haiti. Well, is a child in those countries any less valued than a child in the United States? What if we reversed it? What if we said that only the wealthiest millionaires and billionaires were going to be used for human guinea pigs? Their wives, the husbands, and their children and infants. How long would that be tolerated? And yet we, the people, never ask who these drugs were tested on. What happened to them? Were they followed up? And the answer is, we don't care. Occasional family meal enough to boost kids' fruits and vegetable intake. This is from the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. It says 63% of the children in the United States don't consume the amount of fruits and vegetables they should. And that's because they're not eating with their family. So if the family simply took two meals a week together, that would increase the child's daily fruit and vegetable intake. That's good. And this was done at the University of Leeds. I would like to see parents simply put the law down. I realize you probably believe your child is so busy and you are an indentured soccer mom or dad. You've got to take them to 3,000 different activities a day, give them a credit card, tell them to go to the mall, feel good about themselves. They're too precious to criticize. Let them rant. Let them stay up all night. Let them do whatever they want to do because, well, my God, you didn't have the Immaculate Conception birth, but it was close to it. You have your baby Jesus, right? There's no discipline with intelligence and compassion any longer. So kids eat. I'm surprised that you even know that your child's name, and I'll bet anything that if half of American children were asked, quick, tell me your parents' name, first, middle, and last, half of them go, dude, I don't know. I mean, is that the person that makes my meals, takes me places? We have disconnected people from each other. So why not simply say, as I grew up, you sit at the table. That's where you all come together. You eat a meal. You talk about issues. And you don't leave the table till everyone leaves it. Could you imagine? If you did that, suddenly the person would be twittering and asking for child custody agents to come and take your parents away for abusing you, having to sit at a meal and look at them, listen to them, without your cell phone. You'd actually have to have them go through something similar to cocaine withdrawal. But it would work. And finally, research finds aloe vera may prevent and treat skin cancer. This is from Green Med Info from Case Adams. Quote, research from the University of Belgrade School of Medicine has confirmed what other recent studies have been finding, that aloe vera and its constituents inhibit the process of skin cells proliferation that accompanies skin cancer. So the researchers tested aloimodin, a constituent of aloe, with human skin cells. And after being treated with radiation and once radiated, typically proliferate to the process forming skin tumors. The research found that the aloe significantly stopped the proliferation process. This confirmed aloe's benefit in holding the progression of tumor formation after radiation by the sun. One more reason that it shows good. And by the way, China Medical University also found anti-cancer effects from aloe. A lot of good. That's good. I'm Gary Nall. A short commentary from George Monbiot. The title is Time to Face the Facts. Our level of consumption is pathological. This is short. Researching her film, The Story of Stuff, Annie Leonard discovered that of the materials flowing through the consumer economy, only 1% remain in use 6 months after sale. Even the goods we might have expected to hold on to are soon condemned to destruction through either planned obsolescence, breaking quickly, or perceived obsolescence, becoming unfashionable. And then it goes on. Rare materials, complex electronics, the energy needed for manufacturing and transport are extracted and refined and combined into compounds of utter pointlessness. When you take account of the fossil fuels whose use we commission in other countries, manufacturing and consumption are responsible for more than half of our carbon dioxide production, CO2. We are screwing the planet to make solar-powered bath thermometers and desktop crazy golfers. People in eastern Congo are massacred to facilitate smartphone upgrades of ever-diminishing marginal utility. Forests are felled to make personalized heart-shaped wooden chessboard sets. Rivers are poisoned to manufacture talking fish. This is pathological consumption, a world-consuming epidemic of collective madness, rendered so normal by advertising and the media that we scarcely notice what has happened to us. In 2007, the journalist Adam Welts records 13 rhinos were killed by poachers in South Africa. This year, 885 have been shot. No one is entirely sure why, but one answer is that very rich people in Vietnam are now sprinkling ground rhino horn on their food or snorting it like cocaine to display their wealth. It's grotesque, but it's scarcely differs from what almost everyone in industrialized nations is doing, trashing the living world through pointless consumptions. This boom is not happening by accident. Our lives have been corralled and shaped in order to encourage this consumption. World trade rules force countries to participate in the festival of junk. Government cut taxes, deregulate business, manipulate interest rates to stimulate spending. But seldom do the engineers of these policies stop and ask, spending on what? When every conceivable want and need has been met, especially among those who have disposable money, growth depends upon selling the utterly useless. And that is the current state. Its might and majesty are harnessed to the task of delivering utter junk. Grown men and women devote their lives to manufacturing and marketing this rubbish and dissing the idea of living without it. And so he says. Now, a few comments. I will not go into it in its entirety. It is posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and GaryNall.com. It is an original, in-depth investigative reporting piece. Why does the American Academy of Pediatrics put corporate profits ahead of children's health? I'll just share a few pages with you. Also, today you can now watch the trailer for our new important social issue documentary, Seeds of Death, The Truth of GMOs. You can see the not just the trailer, you can see the testimonials of over 100 people who walked out of the theater, standing room only, Lowe's Theater in Manhattan, and Huntington Arts, standing room only on Long Island, and chose to give a one-word comment, just one word, to describe their reactions to the film. Watch that. And then read this article, because this puts it all together, gives you the organizations that you can support to help you if you feel you want to support a labeling campaign. Yes, we want any food that's genetically engineered to be labeled. That'll help you to get started. I'll quote just 3 pages from our article. The rest is there for you, free to read. The United Nations recently announced that its fifth Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee session, scheduled for next month, would propose a binding treaty to ban ethyl mercury, commonly known as thimerosal, from all medications and vaccines worldwide. That is welcome news, but it has laid bare the battle lines between those governmental health departments and professional medical organizations who value the health of children and those who favor drug profiteering. It is no surprise that the pharmaceutical industry and its special interest groups are moving aggressively to oppose a UN treaty ban on mercury. After all, one big pharma prime directives is to resist any legislation, domestic or international, that threatens its sales and revenues, and vaccines, for example, that have thimerosal in them, like flu vaccine. But it's a big surprise indeed that the American Academy of Pediatrics, once a leader in advocating the removal of mercury from all medical products and vaccines, would now suddenly hold hands with Big Pharma to oppose the UN proposal. Why would the American Academy of Pediatrics join with Big Pharma to oppose the UN mercury ban? Why would it backpedal away from its earlier confirmation that vaccine mercury is toxic and poses serious health risk? Let's look at the history of the AAP's position on mercury, and it'll show us why. In its July 2001 issue of Pediatrics, the AAP released its official position on mercury, quote, "Mercury, in all of its forms, is toxic to the fetus and children. An effort should be made to reduce exposure to the extent possible in pregnant women and children as well as the general population," end quote. Well, that's rather unequivocal. It's poisonous. It's toxic. No woman, no pregnant woman, and no children or baby should have it. And yet, it is in every single flu vaccine given to women and infants and children. What could have caused this? Now we come full force to last week. In the current issue of Pediatrics, former AAP president Lewis Copper writes, quote, "Science clearly documents that we can't find hazards from thimerosal in vaccines. The preservative plays a critical role in distribution of vaccines to the global community. Is a no-brainer. What our position need to be," end quote. Really? Sir, you have unlimited resources. We, on my staff, have found no less than 380 articles on the danger from toxicological journals, all peer-reviewed, all government-based and university-based, that show mercury is toxic in any amount, including one drop, which is in an Olympic swimming pool, be one part per billion. So where do we go from here? Let me just jump over the entire article to just the conclusions to give you some rationale. Here are some of the organizations and monies that flow to the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the AAP's record is dismal. Among its official recommendations favoring corporate profit rather than promoting pediatric health are the following. Routine HPV vaccine. That's correct. The AAP officially supports the CDC's recommendation that all males starting at age 11 be routinely vaccinated with Merck's quadrivalent human papillomavirus, Gardasil. Earlier, the Academy gave its full approval for routine vaccinations of all school-age girls. Since then, Dr. Christopher Shaw and Professor Tomjevic, the University of British Columbia, have published a peer-reviewed study of their investigation into brain tissues from two New Zealand teenagers who died after Gardasil vaccination. In both cases, DNA from the vaccine's human papillomavirus was found embedded in the girls' brain cells, which resulted in the likely cause of death. By the way, there's over 110 girls who've died using the Gardasil vaccine, and many who've been hospitalized, paralyzed. Then we have the psychiatric drugs for four-year-olds. In 2011, the AAP changed their recommendations for prescribing mood-altering psychiatric and psychotropic medications to children. The Academy reduced the age for diagnosing ADHD to 4 years from its prior threshold of 6 years. Its recommendations are that behavioral therapy precedes administering drugs, in particular Ritalin. Yet this recommendation will unlikely be followed. Today, less than 20% of practicing psychiatrists perform behavioral therapy. Prescribing drugs is now the ruling paradigm, and they know it. Absolutely, they know it. Oh, but then again, let us see how much money they receive from pharmaceuticals. Statin drugs for children. The Citizens Commission on Human Rights has investigated the AAP's financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry. At the time, the AAP officially recommended prescribing statin drugs to lower cholesterol for children. What insanity. It had received over $1.4 million in contributions from major statin makers, including Merck, Abbott, and Bristol-Myers Squibb. The Academy has also lowered the minimum age for children to take statins from 10 to 8. And among the statins being prescribed, the FDA has expanded the warning list so your kid now can have liver injury, memory loss, increased diabetes risk, and muscle damage. They fully support genetically modified foods. They also support genetically modified foods in milk and dairy. And they support pesticide use and water fluoridation. Gee whiz, wonder why we still let them have any say so on any level. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me, the way your smile just beams.
I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting worldwide and on our sister stations throughout the United States, and I welcome everyone. Now time for our Conversations with Remarkable Minds segment. My guest, as I mentioned earlier in the program, is Dr. Elizabeth Satoris. And she is an evolutionary biologist. She's here to talk about how do we get humans back into balance with nature and our societies and cultures. Nice to have you with us again.
Hello, Gary. It's lovely to be with you all the way from Mallorca in Spain.
Thank you. I remember back in 1987, there was a lot of hype around a date that was being called the Harmonic Convergence.
Yes.
And people were celebrating it all over the world in order to usher in a new era. Now, 25 years later, all we have witnessed is more oppression, more war and violence, more denialism of truth, whether it is in climate change or denialism of epigenetics and genetically modified foods, or denialism of vaccine safety and efficacy, or fossil fuel industries and the scientists supporting these. And perhaps worse, there seems to be a growing denialism about ourselves as human beings. The gap of inequality widens from a biologic evolutionary perspective. How do you account for this increasing atrophy that has been with us for these several decades?
Well, Gary, I think you're absolutely right in what you're saying, that in the last 25 years, all these things have intensified and gotten worse in so many ways. However, at the same time, during these 25 years, we've seen a huge increase in awareness of the problems that humans are causing on the planet as well. Now, to me, this is a transition time, and I look at things as an evolution biologist, as you know, over billions of years, and especially because I want to know what's on the human agenda right now. And what's on our agenda is that we have to grow up from an expansive, hostile, creative, youthful phase into a mature cooperative phase as global family. And if we don't, we're out of the picture probably as humans on this planet. So I tend to look for the things that are building the new infrastructure, the new way that we want to do things, while the old way is intensifying. Because when you get a bunch of adolescents who are running the biggest corporation in the world, they just want to play more of their game, and they don't know any other game. They really don't know what to do. I talk to some very high-up people in some of those companies, and they haven't a clue what to do, so all they can think of is, give me another fix. Give me another fix before this is over. But there's a lot happening on the good side. And I do want to say to everybody around in your area in New York, you know, I'm an old Hudson River girl. I grew up on the Hudson. And I just want to congratulate everybody that we're now through the solstice. It happened a couple of hours ago, in fact, just about 6 hours, a little more than 6 hours ago. So it's done. The world didn't end. We can stop focusing on end times now and start focusing on the beginning of where we want to go.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. I'd like your views about corporate dominance. In the late 1990s, there was the emergence of civil society to speak out against globalization and the multilateral institutions and their corporate allies who wanted to put the planet in effect into a golden straitjacket, as New York Times writer Thomas Friedman wrote. Mm-hmm. And although we saw this as a great thing, some people saw it as a great thing, what was important at that time was the emergence of civil society. The Cold War ended, and it was being seen that the nation-state lost much of its high position in national and global dominance. And the new landscape, up until 9/11, was a broader playing field between government, the international multilateral institutions like the World Bank, International Audit Fund, and the UN, then the multinational corporations, and finally civil society, each trying to define the role of governance for the future in their own interest. Mm-hmm. So you've written about globalization in the past, so I'd like to hear your analysis of who's controlling what today in the world, and how do the voices of environmental and societal sanity get heard?
Yeah, well, what you do have to do is look at the big picture and see what's on the evolutionary agenda for humans. Now, I'm not kidding when I say it's time for us to grow up, to mature into global family. All through 4 billion years of evolution on this planet, that is what has been going on from the very first bacteria who went through a long, youthful, competitive phase before they became cooperative. And if they hadn't become cooperative, we wouldn't be here. Because the cells our bodies are made of are actually cooperatives of ancient bacteria. And, you know, once they formed those cooperatives, here's what's interesting about this cycle of maturation. Those cooperatives were new on the planet, those big new cells. And so they had to go through their own competitive youth for another billion years before they got cooperative by forming us multi-celled creatures. And now we multi-celled creatures, especially humans, have to go into the cooperative phase. But, you know, we did it once before. We did it at tribal levels when different tribes got together and cooperated to build the first urban centers on the planet roughly 5,000 years ago or so. But those cooperatives were new and had to go through a youth, so they went into empire-building phase. And what you're seeing in the corporate world today is the third phase of empire-building. The first empires were ruled by emperors, the next ones by nation-states, and now by corporations. So this, to me, is a natural evolutionary progression. But we have to face the fact that these are adolescents who have run rampant with the money system and with the corporate production system, raping the planet in order to give us those year-round Christmas shopping malls that you talk about, you know, the idiocy of our pathological consumption. But why do we do that? Because my field of science has given a bum story to the world. It has told us that we are Darwinian, greedy, competitive individualists. And that's only the youthful phase of evolution. He completely ignored the cooperative phase, without which you couldn't have 100 trillion cells that were each as complex as a human city functioning in harmony with each other. And you talk about that health all the time and the need. Look, the bacteria have come right along with us, haven't they? In fact, one scientist quipped that maybe the ancient bacteria built us as giant taxis to get around in safely. Because what we have, 100 trillion cells, we have 10 times that many, or 100 times that many, some say, bacteria in our guts running our immune system. So what we feed them is so important, as you often say. By the way, am a great fan of cinnamon, and it's great to keep colds away as well as eating it if you're a diabetic. I do cinnamon every day, and it's such a yummy thing. Anyway, that's my take on the corporate world. They are the adolescents who have run rampant, and we have to be aware of that, and we have to just stop supporting them. We need to build our own alternative money systems. They're perfectly legal. It can be done anytime you get an agreement among people to use any script you want to trade goods. We have to stop supporting those corporations and start living the way we want people to consume in the future, eating the food we want people to eat in the future, treating each other the way we want to treat each other in the future. It can all be done because those corporations are on the way out. The businesses of the future will only be those that are needed by their communities. So I celebrate crises. I've written a whole article on my website, you know, called Celebrating Crises, because that's the only way nature ever evolves, when it's pushed to. And we humans are really being pushed now, aren't we?
Sure are. I'm going to lay out several interconnected issues and take any one of those that you'd like to address, all right?
Sure, and stop me if I'm talking too long.
No, you're not talking too much. Following up on what you just said, as a person who's counseled tens of thousands of individuals in my career, the ones who are most motivated to make the most significant change and stick to it when it comes to their health are those that have had either a heart attack or a stroke or a near-death experience, and or have gotten a terminal diagnosis, then suddenly they're all aware in that moment. Gee whiz.
Yep.
And then I say, do you want to know how you got here so that you don't repeat the pattern? Mm-hmm. And then it's a whole, okay, let's look at the tipping. Let's look at how you got to where you are. And then they begin to say, aha, now I understand. That said, here are my issues I'd like for you to address. I've been talking for years about why we cannot live the way we are with finite resources in overly congested cities that are precariously positioned to be destroyed by nature. And yet we have not done a single thing anywhere in the United States. And we can't. If you're part of the existing system, you can't. And I'd like for you to address why the President of the United States, the national security agencies, the governors, the legislators, the media cannot be honest about why we cannot tell the people the full truth about how we're not living in balance with nature. And it is inevitable that there'll be a Hurricane Sandy. It's inevitable that we'll do nothing but mock it when it was here. If you didn't see it there, I was telling my audience, you know, get your backup generators, get water, get blah blah blah, and no one did. A few, but the mass, instead they were down there running out to the waves, and as the reporters say, we're down here by, you know, it's going to be hitting us an hour from now, and everyone going around as if nothing could happen because no one was saying this could be devastating. Now, could you imagine had the mayor, the governor, the president said, here's the likely outcome that's going to happen. We've done a model for you. You're going to have 5.8 million people whose lives are going to be turned upside down. At least 200,000 will lose your homes permanently. And you'll be without water, electricity, or gasoline, or food for this amount of time. Then would there have been a difference? But if we said the people in Colorado, in Nevada, New Mexico, in Arizona, in most of Texas, half of Texas, in half of California, in Utah and Kansas, sorry, you're in permanent drought. You're going to have worse fires. You're going to run out of water. You can't support a growing population that is using all these air conditioners, drinking all this water, having industry. You're running out, so we have to relocate you. You're also in an earthquake fault. The earthquake fault's got a nuclear power plant on it. If anyone began to tell the people the real truth, there would be panic. So they'd rather say, we don't want the people panicking, but when a crisis comes, we'll then try to rebuild after it. So our whole effort is look at how well we try to respond to a crisis afterwards. Look at how we never prepare for any crisis before. your thoughts on this whole idea that the only time Americans are going to change is when we have the solar storm that's a giant 30X factor, when we have a nuclear power plant meltdown, when we have the oceans take back at least a quarter of a mile to a mile of the road. By the way, 2 weeks ago in Fort Lauderdale, the network was out there, and it only made it on the Internet. I never saw it on television. The ocean had taken back through the storm, had taken back the beach, the parking lot, the palm trees, the sidewalk, and the major highway. Literally, it was up against the buildings, and all these residents are saying, gee whiz, we never thought this would happen. No one ever told us this was to happen. We only thought we had to have good windows, and now we realize that our buildings are all built. Tens of thousands of buildings on the East Coast are built with those concrete pilings on sand, which means it is not going to be that much time, maybe next year, the year after. All those buildings, tens of thousands of buildings from Fort Lauderdale, Miami, all they're all going to become structurally unsound. Yep. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. Well, you know, you're absolutely right about that. They no preparedness. And yet, the thing that I thrill to is that when the disaster hits, no matter how bad it is, that the vast majority of people cooperate immediately. And that, for me, that is a yes. See, people, we're not just greedy. We know how to cooperate when we have to. Now, I thought because we had the benefit of a big brain and a mind that can build scenarios that, you know, people would learn to look ahead and to warn each other and to avoid disasters. But the older I get, and I'm getting there, the more I see that humans are just like every other species back in the history of evolution of this planet. They always have to be driven by the crises. They don't look ahead. And it's baffling to me that humans who call ourselves intelligent and who do know that we can build scenarios don't do it. Now, of course, one of the reasons is, as you well know, that our government has been bought. And it's been bought by the big corporations who are like these big hunky football players who don't know any other game and are wearing blinders and just want another fix. And so they don't want the people warned. They don't want people to start living sustainably because they want to continue their unsustainable path. And, you know, I mean, if I could talk to them, I would say, thank you for being heroes of the juvenile phase of humanity where you globalized us as a society. Would you like to be now the heroes of the next phase? A plant only grows a certain size and then it starts to flower. It just doesn't keep growing. And if you had grown forever past puberty, you'd be a giant now, completely unsustainable. Your body did it too. It has an expansive economy for a while and then it has to level off. It's everywhere. You can see the need for this. Now, when I was a kid in the Hudson Valley, all the farms along the Hudson were, immigrants in the U.S., including my parents, and they all grew food, and it was all organic because there weren't any chemicals yet for the farms. And so it wasn't expensive to run a farm, and they grew so much food, and that was Depression times. I'm talking I was born in 1936. So, the hobos came to the door and chopped some wood for supper, and all that stuff you read about in a depression, we lived well. We ate good, healthy food. There wasn't any unhealthy food. It was fantastic. And the soil never deteriorated. The water table didn't go down. We used the ice of the Hudson River year-round to feed our ice box. Life was good. We kids were outdoors. We were bonding with nature. So people shouldn't be so afraid of the depression. The worst thing that can happen is that we become dependent on each other, that we rebuild community, that we feed each other again, that we invent new money systems. So the first thing I would say to people is don't panic, but get together, know your neighbors, start being sensible about this thing. You don't need to trust the government. This is a lesson for humans to say, okay, you've practiced individualism, now you have to weave it into community. Are you going to be dependent on letting the government help you out every time something happens, or are we going to get sustainable from the local level up? We don't have a choice anymore. That's where it's going. And that's what people need to talk about and need to act on. and to see it as something positive. You finally get to do it. You finally get to invent things that are clean and green and to live within the bounds of clean, green energy. It can all be done. It can be an absolutely wonderful world. And I do think we need to move people out of fear and anger. There's a big difference between discerning what's going on and being angry in judgment, because that saps your energy to do that. And I like to say to people, imagine you're looking at this human drama as if it's a play on a stage. Imagine what a play is good when there's real villains in it. But you don't say, I hate that actor. You say, wow, is he a good actor? This is a good play. The villain is a real villain. Okay, now go into that play. You're part of it. You get to play in this improvised drama and play your part. So you have to decide what part do you want to play, and you want to do something that makes your heart sing, because other people won't want to join you if you don't. I really believe that people can have a good time in the worst disasters if they really behave like a community and do what needs doing.
Sorry, that's
a bit of a rant.
No, it's not. It's actually very concise. You said it well. And we thank you for coming on. We're out of time. And sharing your insights with us, we're going to call upon you on a more frequent basis because we want to go into some other areas. Also, my next discussion with you, I'd like for you to tell us about the idea, what if we simply forgave all debt and started over?
Oh, yes.
All right.
Wouldn't that be great?
It would be. So I've got some ideas.
I look forward to being back with you, Gary, and my love to all you New Yorkers and others listening.
Thank you very much. My guest, Dr. Elizabeth Satouris, Satouris. She is in Mallorca, Spain, talking with us. And I'd like to thank all of you for listening today. Now, for the next 5 minutes, we will take calls. I'm going to use our talkback time, and our talkback number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Let's see if we have any callers online. And we have Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I got a very interesting email here. This woman says that her friend and she were at a Broadway show, and they believe they saw you at Cat on a Hot Tin Roof premiere. And during the intermission, they overheard you saying it was the worst acting that you've ever seen. And she said, I recognized it was you by the way that you laughed, and they recognized that from the show. She says, by the way you were laughing and the person that you were with, a very tall, good-looking girl, she said it almost appeared as if you were related. So she's asking, who is that girl you were with? And she also is asking, what did you not like about the show?
The girl was my daughter, Shelley. I've taken Shelley to two Broadway shows this week. Just saw another one last night. And Picnic, which I didn't care for. I found it grossly overacted, though there were a couple good actors, and I didn't like the staging and direction. But the one the night before, and one of the things I love about New York, and there are many things I love about New York, is the culture, the arts. And I'm a big supporter of my own way of supporting artists. And there was the opening of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Well, it was starring Scarlett Johansson. Here's why I didn't like it. I didn't like anything about it, by the way. I didn't like any of the acting in it. Scarlett Johansson, to me, has not honored all of those thousands upon hundreds of thousands of actors who, throughout time, mastered their craft. And the idea of acting is no one should know that you're acting. Nothing should be, you shouldn't chew on the scenery. You shouldn't have to sound like you're faking a southern accent, dearie. And everything was faked. Hyper, disconnected, non-central. It's a great play. And so I remember the last group of actors who really as a group mastered their craft and gave us some wonderful performances, at least early on did, was Meryl Streep. There was also Al Pacino before he stopped acting. and are trying to. And someone who really was a good actor, Robert De Niro, but he hadn't done a good film in decades, and William Hurt and Christopher Walken, Harvey Keitel. There was a group that studied at the Actor Studio, or Uta Hagen, or all of the Herbert Borgdorf. These are people that would study 8-10 hours a day. And Marlon Brando and other studio actors that would have people that they would work with tutoring them. Even Clark Gable took months to perfect the dialect for Gone with the Wind. You don't see any of that today. You have what are known as celebrity-themed projects, movies, television, and that's what I felt that we were given. You get a popular celebrity, you throw them into a play, you get a lot of publicity, you talk about how exciting and sexy it is, you know who's going to give you good reviews, and then you get the people to come. Too bad, people who come and think that that's good acting. Because there'll be young people who think that's good acting because they haven't seen good acting from the past. They haven't seen good stage work, good direction, good writing. Those are the little gems that percolate out there occasionally. So I'm not going to sit through a bad play or bad acting. But when I look at someone like her, the moment you get successful, you're surrounded by agencies and managers and publicists and lawyers and go for people. They go for everything for you. And so you no longer have a capacity to see yourself in your career in a legitimate, honest, and authentic way. It's all about now you're a celebrity, so you have to act like one. They'll tip off Page Six which restaurant you're going to be at, as if somehow that's significant, or which Pottery's attending and who's where. And so we're called into the cult of celebrity. What's missing in all this is that someone who's actually appreciated because they mastered their craft, the Laurence Oliviers, the Michael Reddings, their Alec Guinnesses. Those are the people. They're all gone. And with them, the last vestiges of people who understood what it was. When you watched them, you never realized for a second you were watching acting. And all we now see are people with personalities. And most of them are diminutive personalities at that. Hope that answers your question.
Sure does.
Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on the next program, Sunday night, Talk Back, a whole hour at 8 o'clock. Let's say hello to Utrece Lee, who's standing by. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you.
Well, we're talking today about the fiscal cliff, which still stands, and the report on the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi.
Great. Okay. You know, what's interesting is how many people they've thrown in front of the bus. So Hillary, of course, you know, the bad thing is I would bet on the bus taking the greatest damage, not her.
Well, he is getting kind of crowded under that bus.
Yeah, there'll be more, but they will never sacrifice her. The only reason she became Secretary of State, only reason, in my opinion, is because it gave her the credentials she needed to run for presidency.
Yep.
And B, her ego is so dominant that she feels entitled to continue the Clinton legacy and dynasty for another 8 years, which makes 16 years. And based upon the corporate Democrats and the nation liberals and the MSNBC's suck-ups, that will probably happen. So much for learning any lesson from history. But she will not allow herself. She's too powerful, has too many connections to allow herself to be taken down that road.
Oh, sure.
That's
where we're going today.
Good. We look forward to listening to you.
Thank you.
Utrece Lee, coming right now.
Dong, do you know why they're ringing? Do you know why the birds are singing? Well, you're gonna get a big surprise, 'cause I'm gonna put you wise. The bells are ringing.